In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And when they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. This is the word of the Lord.
Now we continue on through famine and coming back into Israel from Moab, and we pick up the story at the end. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When they came together, the Lord made her conceive, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is the word of the Lord. Now, as a pastor and as a youth minister, I have often been involved in those tense conversation between parents and their children, and especially teens. Sometimes it's about drugs or alcohol. Sometimes it's about rebelliousness and maybe even the parents being overprotective. And if it's a teenage girl, many times it has to do with the growing sexual maturity of the teen. Now, my mother was a social worker in the 60s and 70s and dealt with many such experiences between teens and their parents. She often took the teenagers that nobody else could handle. And I remember her telling me when I was in middle school back in the early 70s, you know, several millennium ago, about a particular, didn't name the person, but just the situation, about a particular teenage girl who had gotten pregnant. She asked the girl if she was bound and determined to have premarital sex, if she'd ever considered using birth control. And the girl said she had considered it, but she could not. Birth control, she said, was not part of God's plan and was so against her religion. To which my mother, who was rather pithy, replied, "Are illegitimate children part of God's plan? I rather thought they were not." Lucky for us, God's grace abounds and can make a new path out of some of our bad decisions, as they did for this young lady. Now, Elimelech and his wife Naomi are Israelites, and they're living during very hard times in Israel. A famine is causing mass starvation, and in order to survive, Elimelech and Naomi make the hard choice to move out of Israel. They decide to leave and move into the country of Moab. Now, it's always a difficult thing to do, to move to a new place, especially a new country. You're an outsider. You have to learn all the customs, sometimes the language, the rules of society. But in this case, it's much more difficult because there are generations of enmity between Israelites and Moabites. Israelites were not even allowed to associate with anyone from Moab. In fact, in Deuteronomy, it says, not even to the 10th generation. So if you have someone descended from an ancestor 10 generations ago from Moab, forget it. Even so, Elimelech and Naomi decide that because circumstances are so dire, they will move to Moab with their two sons. While they're in Moab, things go from bad to worse. Elimelech dies. And the two boys marry Moabite women, which is considered a very bad decision at that time in their culture. Then both sons die, leaving three widows to fend for themselves. Now, we know that widows usually had no right to property or capital. Pretty much all of that was in the hands of men. So women could only use what they had, their handiwork or their bodies. And there are not many wonderful careers for either one of those two choices. So Naomi decides to head for home, hoping that a male relative will take her in. She tells her daughter-in-laws to go back to their families. But Ruth refuses with the famous, "Wherever you go, I'm going too," and vows to stay with Naomi and return to Israel with her. It was a brave decision by Ruth, a Moabite woman, to go into Israel. In Israel, they have some hard times, but Ruth catches the eye of an older man, Boaz, a relative of Naomi. Soon, Ruth and Boaz marry, and they have a child. That child, Obed, becomes the grandfather to King David, the greatest and most revered of all Israel's kings. Now, this would surely seem that this was not according to the way things were supposed to be. A Moabite woman wasn't supposed to be accepted in Israel, not even to the 10th generation. And yet, she becomes great-grandmother to David, Israel's most honored king. A man, God says, who is after God's own heart. But like the TV and radio ads say, wait, there's more. If you take a close look at the New Testament, especially read Matthew's lists of Jesus' ancestors, you will find that Ruth, the Moabite, is listed as an ancestress of Jesus, which tells us that God's grace can create beautiful music with some of our rather discordant notes. And if that isn't enough, consider King David's story. At the height of his favor with God and with his people, David stumbles. He becomes enamored of Bathsheba, a wife of one of his high-ranking military officers. After committing adultery with her, he conspires with her to have her husband killed. Now, this is obviously not the way God would want any of us to proceed. And the prophet Nathan tells David that very clearly and with rather brutal terms. Nathan tells the couple that the son they've conceived will die, and sadly he does. Surely nothing good can come from this marriage founded on adultery. And yet David and Bathsheba have another son, Solomon. And Solomon succeeds his father and is still known as the wisest of men, who built Israel up into a nation to be reckoned with. If you and I had been in charge, we might have rejected David and Bathsheba. Probably we would have looked elsewhere for a leader. But God redeemed this unfortunate situation. Because God's grace abounds and redeems truly terrible decision-making to create new possibilities. The truth is, if God allowed God's self to be limited by our actions, there wouldn't be much room for the development of human history. In fact, we would have been written off by now. This means that there is a constant tension in the scriptures, a tension between God's gracious intentions for our life and our life together, and what God does when we mess up God's world. Mercy, justice, intention. You can see it all through the Bible. You can see it in the story of Abraham and Sarah. They go into Egypt, not God's decision. God said, go here, but there's a great big famine. And so Abraham says, well, I'm going over here to Egypt. It's a breadbasket. And Abraham is afraid that the Pharaoh will want Sarah to be his concubine. She's so beautiful and well-spoken that He's worried. So he denies that Sarah is his wife. And so because Sarah has no husband, the Pharaoh decides to take Sarah as a concubine. Good work, Abraham. And yet Abraham is called the friend of God. You can see it in the life of Jephthah. He was a child of an adulterous relationship like Solomon, but rose to become a judge, a leader in Israel, even when the seventh commandment says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And that's the way the biblical record goes, chapter after chapter, in both the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. God has an intention for us as individuals and as a community, but we humans mess it up. God has commandments and divine expectations, but human beings fall short. The good news is for us is that although God's rules and laws are strict, God's nature is gracious. God's grace abounds and allows life-giving possibilities to come from death-dealing choices. It's called redemption. So does this give us license to sin? You know, if you look at Romans 6, you can see that there were many early Christians who thought so. Have you ever heard someone say, well, you might as well do whatever you want. God will forgive you. I don't think God's that stupid. Or as St. Paul says in Romans, should we then sin the more so that grace can abound? And sorry, God is not that dim. The answer is no. If we had truly experienced the grace of God, we will want to live a life of thanksgiving that is worthy of the glorious gift of grace. And remember what comes right before the assurance of pardon? That's the prayer of confession. You know, you can't, you know, no $200, you know, do not pass, you know, you have to go through the confession repentance thing, but God will forgive. Now, I lived in Pittsburgh for many years, and there was on WDUV, which I was a radio host for, there was a classical music show hosted by Ezio Pinza's daughter, Claudia. You might remember Ezio Pinza as the opera singer who originated the basso lead in Rodger and Hammerstein's musical, South Pacific. He was the sexy Frenchman. Through her father, Claudia Pinza met the famous and prickly conductor, Toscanini. Everyone is terrified of this man. And she tells this story. One day, a little girl learning piano, it's probably Claudia herself, is waiting and waiting and waiting for a performance of the orchestra conducted by Toscanini to begin. So the little girl, who is very familiar with everything backstage, just goes out on the stage, sits down on the piano, and starts playing a little childish tune. The audience sort of gasps. And she goes on playing her little kid's tune. And then the audience gasps again. Toscanini, also undaunted, as he always was, comes onto the stage. And the audience is sort of breathless at this point. If you knew the legendary temper of the great conductor, you could understand why the audience was on needles and pins. But Toscanini just sat down at the piano beside the little girl and began to embellish all around her little kid's tune. The result was both charming and brilliant. And so it is with us. We stumble onto the stage of life, and sometimes our little song is childish and sometimes unworthy. But before you throw your performance away or deem it unredeemable, remember the skill of the master who created heaven and earth and you. God is the master not just by the virtue of power and might, but because of what God can do with what we give God and the fact that God chooses to do it. God's grace abounds and calls us back to true obedience to God's life-giving way. God's grace is not cheaply given, but it is totally transforming if we will submit to it. Allow God to transform you or some situation with which you are wrestling. Then I think you will discover what redemption and salvation is all about. Amen.